Hey, I'm Balzi, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. Hi!
Calling all AMS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is seeking a modest increase to its optional student fee for the first time in over a decade. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more. Watch your emails for ballots from the AMS and vote yes for CFRC's fee increase on January 29th and 30th. Thank you for your support.
Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, award-winning Canadian actor, writer, and director, Jonathan Lawrence joins me to talk about his new queer series, Altar Boys. That and more on episode 438. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbecue.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, award-winning Canadian actor, writer, and director Jonathan Lawrence joins me in conversation to talk about his new queer series, Altar Boys, a series that's currently streaming on CBC Gem. We'll find out about the making of Altar Boys, creating content through a queer lens, and more. Plus in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, and on this episode I'm featuring some classic house, some queer Christian music, and more. All that lies ahead as we start journey 438 through Rainbow Country, and our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, British author Kirsty Lowe reads from her latest book, A Short History of Queer Women. Queer women have always existed. Let's put them back in the history books. No, they weren't just friends. By the way, on Amazon.ca, A Short History of Queer Women has a rating of 4.7 out of 5 stars.
Lesbians have always been great at creating spaces for themselves. Take Polish immigrant Eva Kachiva, who in 1925 opened lesbian tea room Eve's Hangout in Greenwich Village, New York. Eve's Hangout was everything you would expect from a Greenwich Village lesbian tea room. There were regular poetry readings, dramatic musical presentations, intense group discussions, cat chat, sex chat, and tea chat. Eva also included men and had a sign on the door that said men are admitted but not welcome. And people say lesbians aren't funny. The bar was successful, but because a successful lesbian is a threat to humanity, the police ransacked the joint. During the raid, the police found Eva's collection of lesbian-centred sexual stories. Eva tried to pretend that they weren't anything to do with lesbianism, but the book's name, Lesbian Love, gave it away. Eva was arrested and charged with obscenity and disorderly conduct. She was deported back to Poland, but somehow managed to make her way to France, where she opened another lesbian tea room that was equally successful. Not long after, the Nazis invaded France. They didn't like Eva, or her successful lesbian tea room. She would be murdered along with thousands of other lesbians in Auschwitz. Just like today, dildos were a common accessory among queer women, only then they weren't as veiny. What's the deal with that? Italian stallion Caterina Vitani was known to carry a leather dildo between her legs and used it to bed over 100 women. Caterina began her bid for top shagger at just 14 years old when she fell in love with her embroidery teacher. The affair lasted for 2 years until the embroidery teacher's father caught them in bed. The father threatened to have Caterina arrested, so she left town and reinvented herself as Giovanni Bodoni. Giovanni was just as charming as Caterina and soon built up a reputation as a serial seducer. That is until she fell in love with the niece of a local minister. Giovanni wanted to marry her, but the minister forbid them from being together due to Giovanni's raunchy reputation. The couple didn't care and decided to get married in secret without the minister's blessing. Unfortunately for Giovanni, the minister found out before they could be married and shot Giovanni in the leg. In the hospital, minutes from death, Giovanni asked for a nun to come to her bed. She then confessed that she had been born a woman and wished to be buried in women's clothing. After Caterina Giovanni's death, a surgeon attempted to find an explanation for what he called those who followed the practices of Sappho. First, he removed the hymen, then the clitoris, followed by the fallopian tubes, the intestines, the liver, and the gallbladder. He then examined them all closely, making sure to use all his expertise and knowledge in the field of biology. And what did he find? Absolutely fuck all. Over in Colombia, Tatiana de la Tierra helped form one of the first international Latina lesbian magazines in the world. Tatiana wanted to empower Latina lesbians through writing and encourage them to challenge social norms. For example, one of her poems, Ode to Unsavory Lesbians, was designed to poke fun at heteronormative societal perceptions of beauty and ugliness, which worked because it's hilarious. Ode to Unsavory Lesbians. I love an ugly lesbian, one who walks with a limp, talks with a lisp, leaves her dentures out overnight by the bathroom sink, wears polyester pants and men's cologne, the cheap kind, has a beard so long she steps on it, sprouts warts on her toes, all 12 of them, carries a spittoon in her breast pocket, chortles at church people. Tatiana also wanted to include non-heterosexual material in the school curriculum. She believed that this would help prevent homophobia in the classroom, as well as educating students on the concept of identity. What a great idea, said nobody, because even today it's a struggle to find anything queer on the school syllabus. Before the AIDS epidemic, gay men and lesbians were often at loggerheads for their political and social differences. Many lesbians resented gay men for being the face of their community, believing them to be sex-crazed cokeheads swanning about in their tank tops, driven by the meat between their legs just like straight men. The feeling was mutual, with screams of fish ringing through the room whenever a lesbian walked into a gay bar. It shouldn't be funny, but the idea that someone would shout fish at me the moment I step foot in a gay bar really makes me laugh. When AIDS came along, everything changed. Lesbians volunteered to help look after the men who had been left alone in their hospital beds to die. They watched as hundreds and hundreds of young men crawled into the hospital, only to be diagnosed with something that they had never heard of and thrown back out. In a couple of months, they would return to die or be used as guinea pigs. To make matters worse, there was a shortage of blood, because gay men had been banned from donating. But, once again, the lesbians stepped up and volunteered their services. One of these lesbians was Barbara Vick, who struck up a deal with a private San Diego blood bank that let donors designate who would receive their blood donations. The San Diego Blood Sisters soon set to work and over the next 5 years organised several blood drives. Barbara knew that although lesbians weren't at the forefront of the disease, they had to do everything in their power to help those who had suffered. There was no longer a divide between gay men and lesbians. It was now an attack on the community. But it wasn't just lesbians who got involved. Meetings to discuss the epidemic were put together by various groups throughout the community. All sorts of lives, all sorts of races, sexualities, genders. There was no time for animosity, no time for separatism, politics or agendas. Everybody had a role and everybody needed to do their part. So they did. To this day, no apology has ever been made to the LGBTQIA+ community, and in 2016, Hillary Clinton tried praising the Reagans for their handling of the epidemic, saying, "Because of both President and Miss Reagan, in particular Miss Reagan, we started a national conversation where nobody would talk about it, nobody wanted to do anything about it." Not only a huge, great, stinking lie, this also served to erase the thousands and thousands of activists who actually did talk about it while nobody was doing anything to help. Look, I like you, Hillary. Really, I do. You should have been president, but spare us the bullshit.
...1969 was a big year. It was the year that saw both the Stonewall riots in New York and more or less decriminalization of gay sex in Canada. The following year, the Americans celebrated the anniversary of Stonewall with Christopher Street Liberation Day. That was the summer of 1970. They didn't actually call it Pride at the time. August 1st, 71 was Toronto's first official gay picnic at Hanlon's Point. It was organized by the Community Homophile Association of Toronto and Toronto Gay Action. 300 people showed up. Now, that wasn't officially a pride, but Gerald Moldenhauer, one of the veterans of those days, maintains that a march down Yonge Street a few weeks later should be called the first Toronto Pride. That was a warm-up for the more famous We Demand demonstration in Ottawa, held August 28th that year, a protest against the inadequacies of Trudeau's decriminalization. By the way, if you want to see some pictures of those early days, check out Gerald's website. It's geraldmoldenhauer.com, and it's spelled J-E-A-R-L-D-M-O-L-D-E-N-H-A-U-E-R. The first official Toronto Pride was actually the next year, 1972, again in August. Then there was a second Gay Pride Week, August 17th to 26th, 1973. That one was national, not just Toronto. There were events and marches in Vancouver, Saskatoon, Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax. The focus was political, on ending discrimination against queers, something that was still quite legal across the country at the time. Then, the following year, 1974, there was Pride number 3 in Toronto, August 17th. I came out at that one, so I remember it very, very well. We marched over to Queen's Park to again demand human rights protection. And then they stopped. There was nothing in 75. People were focused on a national lesbian and gay conference in Ottawa. And again in 76, all of us in Toronto were busily preparing to host the fourth national lesbian and gay conference, which happened in September. Gay Days was a big festival in 78, but nothing called itself Pride again until 1981 after the Bath Raids. That's where the misconception that Pride began after the Bath Raids comes from. 81, I suppose, is significant because that's when the shift happened from August to the last weekend in June to harmonize with Prides across the US. But that's not the first Pride. So when you hear someone say that the first Toronto Pride was in 1981, you should politely point out that that's not quite true. Toronto and other cities in Canada had our own August Prides for almost a decade before that. And there are still those of us around who remember. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Altar Boys.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
It.
Huh?
Wait, no.
Truth.
Truth, babe. Does any of this actually work for you?
Well...
I've never been much of a proponent of the term conversion therapy. I prefer to think of my work as a stratagem of restructuring. I look forward to meeting the young men you will become on the other side of this.
Under the circumstances, I need to investigate the events of the fire and your program here at Cedar Ridge. How did you all end up here?
Where's here? Where even are we, exactly?
I was told that you went back in to get everyone out safely.
Not everyone.
How did you find yourself in this program twice?
Well, I was looking for someone.
Run. Scamp.
I mean, think of where we could go after this. You wanted to see the ocean, right? Pick one.
To myself, the self that I wasn't allowed to see, to share, to love.
You don't have to hide everything in here.
Said that last summer.
Then none of us have changed, I guess.
You know I got you?
I never doubted that.
Well, you're gonna need all of us too. Because even though you didn't get kicked out, they're gonna make you wish that you had been.
You do well to catch up on the lesson you missed earlier.
Don't do anything that I wouldn't.
And that leaves me an embarrassing amount of leeway.
Feet to the fire. Now.
I just can't believe how far it's gone.
You promised we would be okay.
I never asked for any of this. This is a charade, and you know it.
I have an obligation.
Shit, Sonny!
Your father sent along a letter with your application. That man he talks about is still in there. I'm just here to help find him again.
You should probably get your story straight, huh, Scotty? Well, not that straight, obviously.
Jonathan Lawrence. Hi, how
Hello.
Are you?
I'm great, how are you?
I am well. Thank you for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this, especially to talk about Altar Boys. Altar Boys, this is a 6-episode TV series that's out now, out streaming on CBC Gem. You write, you direct, you co-produce, you star in Altar Boys. Let's start from the ground up. What is the story essentially that you're telling in Altar Boys?
Of course. Well, first, I just want to start by thanking you for having me on today. It's wonderful to be able to chat about the project. Yeah. So, I mean, at its core, you know, the story of the series is really, you know, on the surface, you know, it's following a group of young men after they're rescued from a forest fire that tears through this conversion therapy camp that they were attending. And then through that rescue, they're kind of forced to relive the events of the summer. But I mean, really in that kind of retelling of their story, you know, it's really becomes a tale of like community and friendship and sort of that kind of empowerment of identity. And all of that, of course, in the face of adversity throughout the series here. And it really, for me, was always intended to be also a story of beauty, and I think that that comes through really strongly with the project and the crew that sort of put it together. And I think those were the driving forces behind kind of the baseline, the sort of foundation of what we wanted this to be.
So you write the story, and it's based on an award-winning short of yours. What inspired the story that you're telling in Ultra Boys? Like, where does this all stem from?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, I think when I'm looking at roles, I mean, a lot of it starts for me kind of like as an actor. That's kind of how I started in this industry. And then I kind of eventually kind of moved over to writing and directing and sort of wearing some of the other hats. But, you know, at that sort of start of acting and looking at roles that were out there in the world, and, you know, especially like queer roles, and just sort of seeing what you know, things that resonated with me. And so it was just like all these things that I kind of didn't see out in the world, I kind of wanted to create and put out into the world. And so with this particular project, you know, it started as a short film, as you've mentioned, back in 2018 we shot, but the sort of spark for the story, kind of didn't lie within the sort of grit of it. It was the sort of chance to show queer relationships specifically. And I wanted to sort of, you know, examine different, that kind of different array of sort of queer intimacy and queer affection. And, you know, the idea of sort of like the platonic love affair that kind of can take us through a story. Not that we don't sort of also examine romantic love, but it was sort of those variations that I felt that were very limited in what I had sort of experienced, that I wanted to kind of flesh out more and sort of put my lens on and then put that out into the world. And so that's really where that began. And then I realized, actually, as I was writing the story and first sort of talking about it, that a lot of people were actually quite unaware of conversion therapy and what it was, or that it was something that was even still happening, and that it happened even right here in Canada. And so there was also then the opportunity to sort of present that conversation and that kind of visibility to, you know, this, you know, sort of practice kind of in the world. And so it kind of became a bit sort of twofold with that. But I was also able to, you know, funnel my own experiences with adversity and kind of amalgamate that with this very real world place and kind of explore all of that in one. And that kind of became the start of the story.
They often say, write what you know. Write.
Yes.
What you know.
Yeah.
Did you experience conversion therapy camp then?
No, I didn't. And so, you know, my experience with conversion therapy sort of began mostly as, you know, reading kind of articles and sort of hearing different sort of, you know, experiences kind of in documentaries and things like that. But what I did know, what I did recognize, and what was my own was, you know, adversity in the context of, you know, bullying, really, going back to, you know, junior high, and, you know, and when it's in a place where it is so, you know, relentless, and it there's just no sort of time away from that, in this sort of pocket of my life, there, you know, it exists in a way that it creates these feelings of being isolated, of being trapped, of sort of being kind of imprisoned by these sort of, you know, this adversity. And so that was something that I recognized, and that I could kind of amalgamate with, you know, the research that I had done, and create something that was, you know, both informed, sort of from, you know, experiences in the world, but also really from my own kind of lived experience as well.
Okay. So, quote, "This is a cult. This is brainwashing. We are not sick. They are." Unquote. Those are some of the words within this series. Mm-hmm. This 6-episode series is based on your award-winning short film. During the process of creating the series, was there ever a thought of, or maybe a reworking of it to be a feature-length film?
I mean, maybe like a fleeting one, I suppose. I mean, in truth, the series is what I kind of had first in my mind. Mm. I, you know, the whole idea of the project sort of came to me as a series because, The series sort of allowed for a greater infrastructure of story to really dive in and be able to sort of explore all these things that we really wanted to tell. But I think what happened initially was the short film presented an opportunity for us to start exploring this story and these characters and this language and this world in a way that was a bit easier to start, like while we were garnering kind of resources to do the feature or to do the series rather.
Was the short essentially maybe a proof of concept?
I feel like I don't know that it necessarily intended to be, but I think it ended up standing as a really strong proof of concept for the series in the end. Yes.
Well done.
Yeah. Thank you.
Is it fair to say that Winnipeg, Manitoba is another character in this series?
Of course, 100%. You know, when we went into this project, we're sort of on the peripheral of the city for the majority of our filming here, but it was always an opportunity to highlight Manitoba in more ways than one. I mean, Manitoba is such a beautiful backdrop to this story. Our wonderful director of photography, cinematographer Jordan Popowicz, captures the landscape in such a stunning way. And it was what a wonderful way to sort of highlight Manitoba and showcase the beauty that is here. And then it was also an opportunity to really pull from the sort of boundless sort of arts hub that is Winnipeg, and the artists that are sort of both in front and behind the camera, and highlight Manitoba in that context as well. And I just feel like Manitoba really shines, and it's such a wonderful ensemble of sort of the character of Manitoba, as you've sort of, or Winnipeg, as you've mentioned. So I would definitely agree with that statement. I think it very much is a character.
And you're based in Manitoba, aren't you, in Winnipeg?
I am, yeah. I'm in Winnipeg right now, yes, and it is very cold. It is very, very cold.
This show airs in Winnipeg on CKUW-FM. So,
oh, wonderful. Okay.
There excellent. You go.
Great.
The title. Mm-hmm. Altar Boys. Is there a story behind this particular title?
Kind of. Perhaps not as sort of a kind of long one as some of the others, I suppose. But yeah, I think, you know, even with that sort of knowledge of coming into this project where there was a bit of sort of an unawareness kind of around conversion therapy, I think there are some assumptions. And so I wanted to sort of take a title when I landed on it, I'm just like, this felt perfect, because I think people are expecting a different spelling of altar. They're expecting L-A-T-A-R. And that it sort of changes the context of the show. It's just like there's an expectation, and then, you know, there's sort of a change in sort of how we are directing our series and what we're focusing on. And that's kind of, I think, how that sort of title kind of came to be.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Calling all AMS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is seeking a modest increase to its optional student fee for the first time in over a decade. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more. Watch your emails for ballots from the AMS and vote yes for CFRC's fee increase on January 29th and 30th. Thank you for your support.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell, and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi there, I'm Bennett Singer, a documentary filmmaker and the co-director of the new film, Cured. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Jonathan Lawrence, did you always want to be in the performing arts? Did you grow up wanting to be on stage, be an actor?
I did. I really did. And it... I really started in this whole industry as an actor. And then before that, I mean, even as a child, sort of in, you know, worlds of fantasy and play, of course, it was always a really interesting place to kind of just dive in and start kind of exploring sort of different headspaces and different characters and all this wonderful stuff. So that has really existed for as long as I can remember at this point, which is wonderful. So yeah, I've kind of always kind of lived in this realm of sort of performance. I guess I started more so kind of in theater. That was a bit more accessible when I was younger, and then eventually that kind of bled over into the world of television and film.
Was there a moment, was there a flashpoint, was there a spark that made you go, that's what I want to get into? Was there a film, maybe you saw a film or a play or a musical or something that made you say, there is what I want to be?
There's what I want to be. Well, I mean, if I go back really far and I sort of reference sort of like the kind of like inner child in me, I cannot help but reference Jurassic Park and how many times I've sort of did the raptors in the kitchen scene, like in my own house. So that was wonderful. I just feel like, you know, to sort of look at a project, you know, like that, like a film that was just so, you know, transcending this kind of fantastical world of, you know, at the time, you know, my interests of dinosaurs. I mean, I say at the time, I still love dinosaurs, but I mean, it's, you know, there was a great spark for, I think, you know, the larger context of just wonder of what could be created, right? And so that's where the kind of largeness of story and being a part of storytelling, I think, began. And then as I've, you know, consumed more content and experienced more theater and film kind of over my life, it just continued to strengthen that passion and that drive for that direction.
Mm. So this is a gay radio show. I am gay. We're both part of the LGBT community. For me, it started when I was super young, like maybe, you know, 4, 5, 6, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. When I started recognizing that aspect of myself, for you, when did you start becoming aware and conscious of, you know, your same-sex attraction, that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
When did that start crystallizing for you?
Oh, goodness. You know, I mean, sort of like in a retrospect kind of way, I kind of look back and think like it probably was fairly early on. I mean, when I'm quite young, I don't necessarily know that I was, you know, sort of thinking about it in the context of sort of sexuality, mm-hmm, so much, mm-hmm, like not understanding even what that word probably even meant at a time.
I like being around this boy.
Right. Yes, exactly. And so you have like these experiences where you're just sort of like, okay, I'm feeling this, but it's you. So you don't necessarily know that that's different from somebody else's experience, right? It's just kind of like, okay, well, this is what I'm feeling. I don't know that everyone else is not feeling the same way, you know? And so at a time, it doesn't necessarily feel different. I think there's a kind of an interesting pocket of time where it can actually be this kind of very beautiful thing where you don't necessarily feel different because of it. I think eventually, I mean, in my particular sort of, you know, journey with that, you know, it was sort of made evident to me that it was at a particular point in time, you know, and then it became this thing that, oh, yeah, this is not what I'm supposed to be feeling, you know, and that's kind of like what you're being told at that time. Mm. But I would say that, yeah, it was definitely pretty young. And then those feelings kind of, you know, they evolve and they emerge. And I mean, there's fluidity in that too. And, but yeah, I would agree similar to yourself. There is that sort of spark, at a young age. And then I think it gets built with context and sort of understanding, over the years.
As a creative, do you think that the art that you're creating, the art that you're creating through a queer lens.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%. I mean, you know, it seems impossible to remove that lens, you know, from me and my work, because it's from your lived experience. Yeah, exactly. So like every, you know, moment of sort of nuance in my life is sort of, you know, distilled into what I'm creating in that context. And so it would be impossible to sort of remove that lens. And, but I'm excited to bring that lens to the work, right? To showcase, you know, experiences and things that I recognize and things that I love and that I've seen and that I want to sort of, you know, hand off to the world and showcase, like, here's this pocket of the world that, you know, I've seen or I've kind of built or want to see, and I want to hand that off and hope that it resonates and finds audiences that really, you know, can connect with that and sort of, you know, draw and extract, you know, all the wonderful things that they have from their own lens, right? And so, yes, I would agree heavily that it is all coming from a very much a queer lens.
Mm. Who should be telling whose story? Over the last few years, in media, on social media, there's been a real push for, you know, authenticity. Like, mm-hmm. Who should be telling whose story? Should gay people be telling gay stories, and maybe straight people be telling straight stories? You are in the creative arts,
yeah.
And you are creating content for yourself as an actor, as a producer, as a director. How do you see this? How do you come down on who should be playing what role? Should actors just be playing the roles that they are best suited for? Or are you specifically looking for a gay actor to play a gay role? Or should that role go to the best person that auditioned for it gets it? How, right. Where do you land on that?
For sure. You know, it's interesting. It has, I've noticed a lot of that conversation kind of evolving even in the last sort of, you know, seven years, we've kind of seen more expanding conversations. I'm referencing, I guess, a lot of what I'm seeing in terms of actors, kind of specifically in that sort of realm. And so, yeah, I'm always sort of keeping an eye out there and sort of hearing the stories. And they're out there in a way that is so, there's a lot of, you know, opinions that are sort of well articulated and on sort of both sides of it. I think, you know, in the context of our project, you know, when we came into it, we really wanted to infuse as much authenticity in that way as we could, both in front and behind the camera, actually. And so that was definitely an important component with us. And we really strove to do what we could in that realm. I think we've seen, you know, very wonderful performances from non-gay actors playing gay roles, of course. And I think, you know, when that reality is what is being worked with, I think, you know, there needs to be that sort of that sensitivity. There needs to be that sort of understanding. And I think when you have actors sort of working in that way to really sort of build that authenticity, but they may not come from in that own, the kind of only lived experience. I mean, there's some really interesting ways to, I think, help inform that process. And I think we've seen some really beautiful work, right? So it's sort of hard to kind of discredit some of the wonderful work that has come from that kind of framework. But I do know that, like, yeah, where that authenticity can be infused, I think there's a lot of magic to be had there. I think that's a really beautiful, beautiful thing.
Mm. This six episode series, like I mentioned before, is based on your award-winning short film. When you were going back to the very beginning and creating the short film and creating the series, did you ever receive any pushback from telling this queer story that you are ultimately telling? Did you ever receive any, you know, pushback on telling it?
Honestly, no. I think we were quite fortunate in that regard. I feel like we've sort of were able to garner a lot of support behind the project. I mean, the project doesn't sort of get to the state that it's in and being out there and sort of visible and accessible to an audience without that support. And we really were quite quite welcomed in all the avenues that we sort of approached with this particular project. And I think there was, you know, a lot of value that was seen in what we were doing. I mean, we obviously did, you know, came with the value that we knew we wanted to put into it, but I felt very much aware that our, you know, our partners, our funders and our affiliates and everyone kind of around us was also in that understanding. And so that felt really great. There wasn't a lot of pushback for us, which is wonderful. I mean, I hope that we continue to see that same push and support for, you know, continued growth in queer content out into the world, because it's so invaluable and it's so needed. There's such a need, you know, beyond the demand, there's such just a need for queer content to, you know, it sort of expand minds and connect with audiences. And so, yeah, we were very fortunate that we had the support that we did with this project.
And now you have streaming services that are, you know, queer streaming services. Who knew?
Yeah, who knew? Exactly. Who knew?
Thank
Definitely
you.
Not when I was like a kid watching there. None of that was around.
You wear many hats: actor, writer, producer, director, and I'm sure I'm leaving out, you know, many others. For yourself, you feel most comfortable doing what? What aspect of the creative arts do you feel most comfortable doing?
Interesting. That is a great question. I mean, for me, in the way that this, all these kind of hats kind of came together and how that kind of formed, it was, you know, I don't really look at them as sort of being mutually exclusive. It sort of all falls under this kind of one role of storytelling, right? There's an opportunity to sort of bring a sort of a reference point and perspective as a writer, which is wonderful. And then you have that, you know, further translation of that as a director. And then you can, you know, in its kind of final form, articulate that as an actor. And so it's kind of one journey, you know, for me, because I started really in film, like in this sort of, in the kind of the world of cinema kind of industry, kind of doing all of them. It wasn't like a slow kind of progression of kind of adding more hats. I kind of started that way. So that is a strategy that I'm very familiar with. That, and yeah, it's interesting sort of the way. I mean, it might have been a different journey if I kind of was only like, I mean, I started in theater, I guess, as an actor, and kind of built that, but it really did start that way. So it kind of feels kind of all one. I mean, I enjoy so many pockets of all of them, right? And it which is really wonderful. So it's hard to sort of, you know, break them apart and kind of look at them individually in a way. But I mean, they are nuanced, of course. They are very different roles. And I mean, I guess if I sort of had to break it down, I mean, so much of it is sort of channeled through myself as an actor. You know, like I write what I want to explore as an actor and sort of then want to tell as a director, right? So that kind of reference point of sort of sparking a story is usually from like a point of like, where, what headspace do I want to be in? Like, what do I want to live? And so in that sense, that could maybe be where I would have the most sort of comfort in a way. But yeah, it's all a storytelling role to me. And so I hope that answers the question well.
I recently saw an interview with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah,
and
nice.
She was talking about at the age of 60 something, she's now beginning to, or at least over the last few years, has taken the bull by the horns, so to speak, and started creating projects and roles for herself to play at the tender age of, you know, 60 plus.
Right.
For yourself, creating Altar Boys, Are you creating the projects and the roles, especially telling queer stories that you want to be part of, that you want to tell, as opposed to, you know, waiting for an agent or someone to send you a script with a role in it?
Right. I mean, yeah, it very much starts kind of from that sort of standpoint. I think, you know, in this industry, it's important not to just be waiting by the phone in a way, right? You sort of got to get out there and create your own opportunities. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, from a sort of content standpoint, it is, what are roles that I want to see? Like what am I not necessarily seeing in sort of queer content that I want to portray or jump in or share, you know, from my own sort of lived experience and everything in that context. So yeah, I do think that is sort of kind of what is sort of happening with how the roles kind of develop and, you know, what you want to see more of in the world. And it's important to have, you know, multiple things kind of on the go as well. But yeah, it definitely stems from a place of just being able to build opportunities for, you know, the collaboration as well that you're working with, because that is so much, you know, part of it. I mean, even wearing the sort of multiple hats that I do, I mean, that's really only made possible by the, you know, wonderful ensemble of artists that I get to work alongside, right? So it's also kind of infused by community, right? By the arts community and that and what we all want to tell.
But also to the environment that we're in with, you know, all these platforms that are available that need content. There are more opportunities for people like us, for creatives, to tell, especially to tell, you know, LGBT stories, whatever they may be.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that it's wonderful to see sort of the expansion of just queer content. And I mean, the streamers just provide so much access to being able to share that. Like when we came into this, I mean, we had so much support from CBC Jam when we did our pitch to them. Mm-hmm. And that was wonderful. And you know, it allows us to get out there and tell the story. And then they have a platform that allows us to share that story in a very accessible way, because that's really important, right? To sort of reach your audience and find your audience and sort of build that viewership, if, you know, to, and hopefully kind of find that resonance with the sort of the viewers that are able to watch it, is that it is accessible. That's so important. And so the streamers do make that such a wonderful component, and CBC Gem is just has been such a wonderful platform to be able to help us get that work out there. And yes, very different from you know, times before, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, great, so invaluable to see that expansion happening in all the ways that it can be.
Best feature film, best first time director, best short. Those are just three of the awards that you have garnered. You are a multi award winning creative, actor, producer, director. What do those accolades, those awards, what do they mean to you to receive those?
I mean, it's wonderful to have, you know, a recognition for the work, because, you know, all of that, you know, it's all sort of a domino effect. It all builds to help get the next thing off the ground, right? And so that's really important, right? It's so wonderful to receive the recognition for the work and the audiences and sort of like the industry kind of recognition, the recognition from your peers is sort of existing in such a way to sort of help, you know, we can kind of all help elevate the work together kind of in that way. And so that it has been wonderful to see that the projects are gaining traction in that context, recognizing the work of everyone involved, because it is such a collaborative process, right? So we're in it, like we're in the thick of it doing the job, and we know what goes into it. And so to then have the award sort of there to recognize that further is just so wonderful. And it really does help to sort of, when we look down the road and on the horizon at the next project, all those things really sort of help, and sort of we can kind of reflect back on as we are looking to build the next thing, you know, that recognition does help to strengthen, you know, our pitch for the next project, and sort of to help us keep telling more stories. And so, I mean, that's so important to us, that we can just sort of keep sharing.
Because of the success of Altar Boys, do you feel any sort of anxiety, any sort of pressure, any sort of feeling some kind of way to create something that's going to resonate again? Do you feel any sort of, you know, any kind of way for your next upcoming project because of the success of Altar Boys?
For sure. I mean, I think in the context of anxiety, I just kind of live there most of the time anyways. So I'm always sort of in a little bit of an anxious sort of mode. But I mean, yes, I suppose to a degree. I mean, it's, you know, as a sort of an ensemble kind of coming together to create something, I'm just like, it's, you know, there's something in that process as it's happening that you the camaraderie that is there, the rapport and sort of the community that is built in that process, you know, that's going to show up on screen. And in that sense, you know, it's, we know what's there to a degree, right? But it's great to sort of take it off of, you know, it's been in our minds, it's been ours for so long, and then just hand it off to an audience and then just kind of see how it evolves. It, you know, anytime that it's out, once it's out in the world, it kind of takes on its own life. And it's interesting to see how that happens, like what forms, you know, from that sort of experience. And I mean, we've been so fortunate enough to have had, you know, a wonderful response to the series, to this first season of the series. And so, I mean, it's not so much a pressure, but there is a drive there. There is an ambition to keep, you know, presenting work that will reach audiences and will sort of connect and resonate and land in hopefully a very positive sort of way. So, but I mean, I think I would look at it more so as a drive to sort of continue than an anxiety sort of specifically, but, it is an exciting place. I mean, it's, you know, it's an industry of a lot of question marks and in terms of, you know, what's next. But I think wrapped up in that question mark is all the promise. It's all the possibility as well as just uncertainty. And I think that's an exciting kind of place to be.
Well said, well said. Here's my last question for you, and it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've in this particular case, they've experienced Altar Boys?
Oh, well, I mean, I hope that people take away the beauty from the story that, you know, we worked very hard to put into the story. I hope that they see the sort of empowerment of sort of community and chosen family that we examine through this story. I hope they see the richness of queer relationships, of friendships, of romance, of intimacy and affection. Really are just sort of able to see us, really sort of take away sort of like what is, you know, right there is sort of in front of them in the story is sort of that queerness. And I think that's a really wonderful thing, whether, you know, you recognize it or we're there to introduce it to you to sort of start. I think all of that is a very beautiful thing. And, you know, from a sort of project standpoint, I hope people take away all of the wonderful work that this sort of exceptional team of artists have put into this project, because they are such a wonderful group of artists that I got to work with. So that I think really sums up what I hope is sort of taken away from the viewing experience of our series.
Well said, well said. Jonathan Lawrence, well said, well done, well made, well produced, well directed, well acted, well written.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's try this again.
Oh, damn it.
Huh?
What are you going to
do? Truth. Truth, babe. Does any of this actually work for you?
Well...
I've never been much of a proponent of the term conversion therapy. I prefer to think of my work as a stratagem of restructuring. I look forward to meeting the young men you will become on the other side of this.
Under the circumstances, I need to investigate the events of the fire and your program here at Cedar Ridge.
How did you all end up here?
We're just here. Where even are we, exactly?
I was told that you went back in to get everyone out safely.
Not everyone.
How did you find yourself in this program twice?
Well, I was looking for someone.
Front. Scamp.
I mean, think of where we could go after this. Right, you wanted to see the ocean, right? Pick one.
To myself. The self that I wasn't allowed to see. To share. To love.
You don't have to hide everything in here.
You said that last summer.
Then none of us have changed, I guess.
You know I got you?
I never doubted that.
Well, you're gonna need all of us too. Because even though you didn't get kicked out, they're gonna make you wish that you had been.
You did well to catch up on the lesson you missed earlier.
Don't do anything that I wouldn't.
And that leaves me an embarrassing amount of leeway.
Feet to the fire. Now.
I just can't believe how far it's gone.
You promised we would be okay.
I never asked.
for any of this.
This is a charade, and you know it.
I have an obligation.
Shit! Got it!
Your father sent along a letter with your application. That man he talks about is still in there. I'm just here to help find him again.
You should probably get your story straight, huh, Scotty? Well, not that straight, obviously.
Altar Boys is currently streaming on CBC Gem. For more information, simply visit gem.cbc.ca and search Altar Boys.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Hi, I'm songwriter and producer Jim Valance, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, Body Strong, Sylvester.